Yep, that's it.
Right, welcome to the last session of our seminar series, from Making Britain Project. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Michelle Barrett, who's from Queen Mary University of London. Michelle Barrett studied artistic and literary responses to the First World War as a graduate student and completed a doctorate on modernism and Virginia Woolf. And in recent years, months, she's got back to working on the First World War period, which are also reflected in her teaching at Queen Mary. And she's recently been awarded a Leverhulme Fellowship to study shell shock and a British Academy grant to research the colonial politics of commemoration. Some of her publications include Casualty Figures, Five Survivors and the First World War, which is forthcoming with Verso, and also a forthcoming article on Subalterns at War, Colonial Forces and the Politics of the Imperial War Graves Commission, which she's going to speak on today as well.
Yeah. Great, thank you. Well, thanks very much for inviting me. They're actually not forthcoming, either of those. They're out. Yeah. And what I've got to say today is a sort of spin-off from the Subalterns at War piece, sort of using comparable material, which is a research project that I did on issues of race and creed in using the archives of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Okay, so am I all right for about 45 minutes?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to start with a reference to Jane Urquhart's, I think, remarkable 2001 novel, The Stone Carvers, which imagines a young woman of European woodcarving ancestry travelling from a village near Hamilton, Ontario, to Vimy Ridge in northern France, where the Canadian First World War Memorial was being built. Here's the figure, let's see, of bereaved Mother Canada mourning her fallen sons being unveiled in the 1930s. And this is how she is today. Now, disguised as a man, Clara obtains modest work on the monument, and early one morning she steals into the workshop to carve the face of one of Walter Allward's allegorical figures, such as this one, in the image of her dead lover, Eamon. When Allward, in the novel, disturbs her, he's angry that you've ruined my torchbearer, and he explains that he'd wanted this stone youth to remain allegorical, universal, wanted him to represent everyone's lost friend, everyone's lost child. Allward, we are told, wanted the stone figure to be the 66,000 dead young men who had marched through his dreams when he had conceived the memorial. But the face that Clara was carving had developed a personal expression. It was becoming a portrait, which had never been his intention. Confronted by this determined young woman, Allward realizes that she has allowed life to enter his monument, and he relents. You can finish carving his face, she agrees. In fact, the figure that she's carved is the torch bearer. This is a maquette for it, and in fact, the face is actually barely visible. But Clara Becker's desire to impose the face of one particular young man onto the body of Allward's universal young man can be seen, I think, as a metaphor for the general philosophy of commemoration that prevailed on the Western Front after the First World War. The Imperial War Graves Commission was attempting to bridge a gap between the universal and national, the personal and individual. Headstones were to be of a standard size, let into the ground on beams that would keep them in perfect rows. Famously, there would be no distinction of military rank, and hence also no distinction of civil rank or social class. On the body of the blank headstone would be carved the face of the individual, their name, their rank and regiment or unit, their religion, perhaps some personal words from the family too. Of these markers of the individual, the name was the most important, a fact that came into its own with regard to the commemoration of those with no known grave, the missing. At Vimy Ridge, the 11,000 names of the missing, about a sixth of Canada's casualties, form an important element of the design and structure of the monument. For the fictional Clara Becker, too, the name is important, as she's being helped to chisel out Eamon O'Sullivan's name herself. Allward says to her, "Let it go out of your heart and into the stone." And these are the, not Clara Becker, obviously, but the masons who are carving the names into the Vimy Ridge Memorial. Now, the principle of the individual name forming the basis for modern commemoration is held up as a mark of progress. Publicly naming each private soldier is democratic. So powerful was this feeling after the First World War that monuments were actually designed specifically to maximise the wall space for all the names of the missing. Over 70,000 at the Somme, over 50,000 on the Menin Gate. And Thomas Lacour has suggested that the need to name all these names arose because there was no agreement, or no agreement on the cause for which the war had been fought. And he calls it commemorative hypernominalism. You'll see, as I go along, why I'm starting with the importance of the name. I'm going to get there. The Imperial War Graves Commission's strategy was based on equality of treatment. Fabian Ware himself, in The Immortal Heritage, published in 1937, stressed that no distinctions would be made on the basis of rank or class, and many of the early documents of the Commission make this clear. For some while, however, the present Commonwealth War Graves Commission, it's the same outfit but changed its name in 1960, has claimed that the principle of equality applies also to distinctions of race and creed. Now, this may be true now, but certainly was not true after the First World War, and given what we know of the imperial context of that war, it would be very surprising if that had been the case. The self-governing dominions offer examples, such as Vimy Ridge and Delville Wood for South Africa, where extensive naming occurred on the Western Front. Whether this is inclusive is a source of some debate, since black Africans were until recently ignored by the latter, and First Nations Canadians neglected by the former. I'll come on to the specific case of India and the armies of undivided India, pre-partition India, later. Britain's colonies, however, were a different matter altogether, and this point can be decisively clarified by a letter approved by the Imperial War Graves Commission and found in its archives to be sent to the governors of the Crown Colonies from Downing Street in 1921 by Winston Churchill, then Colonial Secretary. Churchill stressed the importance of equality of treatment for the graves of all and advised that local administration should not erect memorials different from those adopted by the Commission. Churchill's letter makes clear that this policy simply does not apply to colonial natives. They are not included in that all. In a separate paragraph, he deals with these excluded people as follows. The erection of memorials to the memory of native troops, carriers, etc., depends upon local conditions. In ordinary circumstances, the Commission would not erect individual headstones, but a central memorial in some suitable locality to be selected by the government concerned. Well, there were important differences in the way that different parts of the empire were treated. And to contextualise what happened in relation to India, it's useful to consider first what happened in Africa. And from the point of view of South Asian issues, you're going to have a long digression on Africa, because I think it really does help us to see what happened in relation to the Indian Army. Now, back in 1922, the Imperial War Graves Commission was in discussion with the colonial authorities in Africa about how to deal with the casualties of the war there. It's estimated that upwards of 200,000 Africans died in the various campaigns in Africa itself in the First World War, a figure that includes porters and carriers, as well as African soldiers fighting on the British side. The files of the War Graves Commission contain notes of a meeting they had with the governor of Tanganyika territory in East Africa, now Tanzania. The commission had been canvassing opinion as to whether native Africans who had died should be individually commemorated or not. The governor of Tanganyika was on the side of those who thought this would be a waste of public money. He considered, this is a quotation, he considered that the vast carrier corps cemeteries at Dar es Salaam and elsewhere should be allowed to revert to nature as speedily as possible, and did not care to contemplate the statistics of the native African lives lost in trying to overcome the transportation difficulties of the campaign in East Africa. Broadly speaking, the Commission accepted the view of the British colonial authorities, which was that the Africans had not reached the stage of civilization at which individual graves would be appreciated. They decided to put up central memorials in the towns commemorating unnumbered and unnamed African lives lost. They differentiated sharply, if predictably, between the graves of whites or Europeans, including their German enemies, and those of natives. White graves have been, they called them white graves, have been maintained in perpetuity, often through exhumation and reburial in concentrated cemeteries. Many identified graves of Africans were simply abandoned in a move that commission staff wryly called sending them missing. The names were simply reallocated to the registers of memorials to the missing. Religion was important as well as race, and there's evidence of converted Christian Africans being treated differently from their pagan brethren. All this was going on in the context of a commission led by Sir Fabian Ware, a man for whom equality of treatment was the watchword. And subsequently, the War Graves Commission has tried to wipe out this blot on their egalitarian escutcheon with very mixed results. Now, several of these central memorials were put up in Africa, with perhaps the best known being the one in Mombasa, Kenya. Here it is. It's situated at the southeastern end of Jomo Kenyatta Avenue. The memorial consists of fine bronze sculptures by Stevenson of four types of men who contributed to the East African campaign. They include Askaris, African soldiers fighting with the British Army, often with the King's African Rifles Regiment. And they are this figure on the left and this figure centre right. Arab riflemen, usually Yemenis or Hadramuts, which are centre left, and porters and carriers, the figure on the right. I use the word type advisedly, for the brief was specific in requiring typicality. In 1923, the sculpture sent to East Africa for exact copies of the men's uniforms and equipment, and J.N. Cormack, the IWGC's Deputy Director of Works in East Africa, included all this equipment and had it shipped to London. An important part of the consignment was photographs, ringing with taxonomic ethnic interest. Cormack asked the officers to comment on the rank and file, and these are the kinds of quotations that they came up with. The figure in G is a good example of the Bukedi tribe and is a typical specimen of the Askaris recruited in Kenya and Uganda. Photographs A to D, men who served with the Arab Rifles, are annotated with notes on the types of men engaged. Photographs TUV show studies of the best type of porter, who were principally drawn from whichever tribe. Annotations of Askaris also indicate what are considered typical porter heads. These central memorials contain no names, and they don't even actually contain numbers. Other troops, notably, as we'll see from the Indian Army, as we shall see, were commemorated numerically, which meant that lists of the names existed, but it was decided not to put them on the memorial. Instead, an exact number of casualties was attached to the military unit concerned. But with these African memorials, what appears are general inscriptions. On the plinth below, in several African languages as well as in English, are the specially composed words of Rudyard Kipling. This is to the memory of the Arab and native African troops who fought, who were the feet and hands of the army, and to all other men who served and died for their king and country in Eastern Africa in the Great War 1914-18. The final sentence, if you fight for your country, even if you die, your sons will remember your name. Kipling was a genius at the finely calibrated epigraph in tricky situations. He was perfectly aware that these men, and presumably some women, would need to be remembered by their families, as neither the colonial authorities nor the War Graves Commission would be doing it. On the present day Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, the figure for native deaths in East Africa is put at almost 50,000, and it is stated that, quote, as no complete record of their names exists, no names appear on the memorials. This is undoubtedly true today, but in the years following the First World War, the argument about inadequate records often functioned as a screen for something much more simple, discrimination. Consider the policy made at the IWGC in the 1920s and stated by Lord Arthur Brown, its principal assistant secretary. In 1925, discussing graves in Nyasaland, Brown's opinion was recorded as being that in the case of native African soldiers, headstones should not be erected unless obliged to do so. Native graves in Africa, were not usually maintained. Mostly they were not accorded a headstone, and many of their known occupants were redefined as missing. By and large, Africans were not commemorated individually, and their graves were allowed, to use this expression that keeps coming up, to revert to nature. I'll give you some examples of decisions that are recorded in the archives. At a meeting in 1924 about East Africa, Brown, principal assistant secretary, stated that the usual policy of the commission was not to erect headstones on Indians and natives, although identification of natives might be known, but European Cape boys would be commemorated. This is explained elsewhere in the same file, where he states that coloured South Africans are not reckoned as natives. They are half-castes and should be treated as European Christians and commemorated precisely as British soldiers. Similarly, as regards West Indian natives, i.e. Negroes in West Indian regiments, they were commemorated individually, where buried in East Africa, Christians. The general rule for African natives was no individual commemoration. Now, commission officials went to some lengths to administer these policy decisions. Clerk of Works Milner, overseeing the concentration of graves into selected cemeteries in East Africa, engaged in a close scrutiny of the remains that he found in a common grave at Selita Hill. On this occasion, he found the remains, which he identified by shape of skull and other anthropometric devices, to be those of 14 Europeans and 6 Indians, which I describe in the Subalterns at War article. On the same trip, he found another common grave near the railway station at Taveta. He reports that, quote, on 15th May 1923, I excavated the 11 graves at this place and gathered 11 remains who were undoubtedly not Europeans, as the shape of the skulls, leg and arm bones were different. Also, the teeth were in perfect condition. The image of War Graves employees sent out from London, picking through human remains in order to race them, is unexpected and disturbing. And religion, too, was an important issue. Following the widespread practice among British travellers in Africa, the natives were regarded simply as pagans, as seen in the Blunt memo. The director of works on tour stated that pagan natives have no regard for graves. Central memorials had been decided upon, and graves would revert to nature. In 1925, the commission was working at the cemetery at Rufiji River in East Africa. Mr. McCormack again in charge. Captain Miskin, the War Graves Registrar, wrote in June that year to the Director of Records about Cormack's report, attempting to rescue 2 graves of Christians from the revert to nature policy being applied to African natives. He wrote, quote, the burial book shows that hospital boy Zenza Agriza was a Roman Catholic, and 13050 Cape boy William was evidently a Christian too. I think Major Cormack should be asked about those 2 cases and whether their bodies could be found and removed to Morogoro. The headstone decision was, on the ground, an evaluative one. The same Major Cormack, who was urged to retrieve for commemoration the bodies of the 2 Christian boys, would have agreed with the request. In a 1922 report, he had earlier noted that among numerous other natives who died in the vicinity, 9 had been buried in the Christian cemetery, and he concluded that they may be regarded as Christians and worthy of commemoration by the standard type of headstone. And in fact, those two boys were rescued and given individual memorials. By 1930, these policy decisions had become routinized. Arthur Brown, summarizing the position for West Africa, was able to state that so far as I know, nothing has occurred to alter the policy of the commission under which all known European graves in West Africa will have headstones and all natives, whether buried in known graves or not, will be commemorated on memorials. He added that for statistical purposes, I should imagine that the only course practicable for the great majority of West African natives is to count them as missing. In 1956, a military man, General Sir Frank Simpson, wrote to the War Graves Commission, bringing to their notice the uncared-for condition of two such First World War graves in British Cameroons, which he had stumbled across in the old German botanical gardens in Victoria. He reported to them, quote, "They're enclosed by a dilapidated fence, much overgrown. The small enclosure itself is also overgrown, and the two graves, which are of African soldiers, one of the Nigerian regiment and the other of the Gold Coast regiment, have wooden posts which are rotting and the inscriptions on which are nearly indecipherable. I was told," he continued, "that there are several other similar graves dotted about the surrounding country." Now, Simpson was an advisor to the West Africa Committee of the War Graves Commission, and Arthur Brown's successor had to write and explain to him what the policy had been following the First World War. He said, "The Commission's records confirm the existence of two natives' graves in the Victoria Gardens, but in accordance with the policy, no action has been taken by the Commission to maintain them." There's some evidence that these policies continued to apply after the Second World War too, and that perhaps the Commission began to foresee the Simpson problem. In 1947, M.J. King in London wrote to Captain Schultz at the Cape Town office of the War Graves Commission, stating that, quote, "The policy of the Commission will be to obliterate isolated, unmaintainable native graves, commemoration being made on the central memorials. I understand," he continued, "that great importance is attached to complete obliteration when graves have to be left." In the aftermath of the First World War, it became clear that the notion of an unmaintainable grave was flexible. Isolated white graves were exhumed and reburied in better locations, while isolated native graves were declared unmaintainable and the occupants declared missing. Now, in comparison with the way native African troops were treated, the soldiers of the Indian Army were highly regarded by the men of the Imperial War Graves Commission. A more engaging side to Lord Arthur Brown emerges here in his knowledge of Indian cultural forms. In September 1923, he explained to the Director of Works that the religion of natives of India can always be told from their names. He even offered to involve himself personally. "If you will send me down names, I'll probably be able to say what they are." Earlier that year, Brown had written to Sir Frederick Kenyon, the director of the British Museum, for information on a couple of points on which he'd drawn a blank at the India office. The first was what religious emblem to use on the headstones of Indians buried in France whose religion is given as animist. In the African context, of course, such people would simply be seen as pagans and there would be no headstone to worry about. But Brown takes a far more sympathetic stance here. Quote, "As far as my experience goes, Indian animists appear to worship the spirits of the jungle, water, mountains, etc.," he says chattily, and wonders if it might be best to put up a headstone without any religious emblem. He asked Kenyon for advice, too, about Buddhist headstones, which has also stumped the India office, apparently. I suggest inscribing the characters Om, he writes, "as I understand that this forms part of the usual Buddhist invocation. Can you obtain any advice on this point?" Kenyon consulted an expert at the School of Oriental Studies, who opined that there was an objection to Om in that it was a word rather than a symbol, and proposed a Vajra instead. To this, Brown, evidently no slouch on Buddhist symbolism of the adamantine or firmness of spirit, replied, I have a good specimen of a Bhutanese Dorje myself, but it is closed at the ends and not open as in your sketch. Brown thought that this matter of the Buddhist symbol was important enough that he made inquiries in India about it too. And he also took to ticking off his staff for failing to pay sufficient attention to religious and cultural matters. In January 1925, he wrote very sternly to the Director of Records at the Commission, pointing out that it would be a grave mistake to erect a memorial to Hindus and Sikhs in an exclusively Mohammedan cemetery. More on this problem later. By the end of 1925, Arthur Brown was getting frustrated at the fact that the India Office was not willing to take responsibility for the spelling of Indian names, which he said, and I quote, does not absolve the Commission from doing their best to engrave inscriptions at which no one with a knowledge of India can reasonably cavil. He chastised the Director of Works on several points, including the need to remove Mohammedan names from any memorial referencing cremation. Quote, there is no grosser insult to a Mohammedan than to suggest that his body has been burned. At this point, he revealed why he felt that it was the duty of the Commission to exercise great care in the matter of religion. Quote, sorry to say this, there is much religious fanaticism in India, he said, and there are many Indians on the lookout for any excuse to make trouble. He was particularly anxious to avoid any mistakes which could be used as a weapon to attack the British or Indian governments. Now, the major casualties of the Indian Army in the First World War occurred in Mesopotamia and are commemorated there on the Basra Memorial. This was unveiled in the late 1920s, 1929, in fact, standing on the bank of the Shat al-Arab waterway. In the early 90s, it was removed by Saddam Hussein and re-erected in the desert near Nasiriyah. And there it is in the desert, subsequent to its post-early 90s removal. Invading British forces found it in 2003 and took great interest in finding their regimental comrades of the First World War, particularly the Black Watch Regiment was there in both instances. And there's much online material about their attempts to restore this dilapidated monument. And there's a picture of the inside of the colonnade where you can see how much in need of restoration it is. Now, approximately 8,000 British soldiers were commemorated there by name in the usual way. But for the Indian soldiers, the Commission took a decision that departed significantly from the principle of equality of treatment. A telegram sent from the Commission to the Indian Army's headquarters states the facts boldly. Basra Memorial, total number of missing from Indian Army commemorated by name, officers 665, numerically other ranks 33,222. The 33,000 Indian casualties were differentiated by rank. The 665 Indian officers were commemorated individually by name, while the huge number of other ranks, the sepoys, were recorded on the monument merely as the number of men killed from each military unit. Now, to take an example, I want to look at panel 55 of the Basra Memorial, on which the deaths of men from the 36th Sikh Regiment are commemorated. I'd have to tell you, this is not just an example. This is my prized possession, this image, because they're almost impossible to get hold of. This is a panel about the 36 Sikhs, and I'm going to just to show you that I can make this a bit clearer. This is a photoshopped sort of close-up of it, where you can see the crucial words I want you to see are there's Harnam Singh and 149 other Indian soldiers, and then and 51 other Indian soldiers. I think it's clearer in that. But if we go back to the main panel, what you have here is On the left, Captain Gray and Captain Martin, two British officers. Then you have six Indian officers, four Subedars and two Jemadars, Gurmukh Singh, Hanan Singh, etc. So we have six Indian officers in a Sikh regiment and two British ones and 149 other Indian soldiers. Patterns repeated below with two other units being named. Other Indian soldiers is the largest number that I've seen recorded as and other Indian soldiers of one particular unit. And that comes from Fergal Keane, who visited this memorial in 2003 when it was encountered. And he commented that the inscription to Subedar Mahanga and 1,770 other Indian soldiers was, he said, as sad a sentence as any I've read in war. Now I'm going to continue with this example, just because I'm so thrilled I've got a picture of it. The fate of the casualties from the 36 Sikhs. Their names are not engraved on the Basra memorial, the names of the rank and file. They're not engraved on the memorial, but actually they do exist in the register of the memorial. Generally, cemeteries and memorials have a published register, which is available to visitors at a box at the entrance, and it lists more particulars, including family details, than it's possible to put on a memorial. Registers for this memorial at Basra were compiled in the usual way, and they're published. So we can see the names of these men who were commemorated numerically. The first entry reads, Amar Singh Havildar, 1st of Feb 1917, son of Ram Singh, etc. Now, if you look for the name of Singh A in the Debt of Honour Register of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, you will not find it. If you enter the name Singh in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission database for all forces for the entire duration of the war, a total of 12 records that match your search appears. You can't see it very well. You might have to just take my word for it. But if you put Singh in the surname box, what comes up is these 12 and only 12 entries. The name of Captain Martin, on the other hand, tells a different story. As we could predict, Captain Arthur Derrisley Martin of the 36 Sikhs, who died in April 1916 at the age of 30, the son of William and Mary Martin of Ilfracombe, Devon, is remembered with honour and commemorated in perpetuity by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. The certificate that appears for printing shows an unusual image, a display table containing two large books. Those are the books with the Basra Memorial Notice, and that's an image from the display over the table. So there are two large books, a map, pictures of Iraq, and some text. And the caption reads, the precise wording is this, the rolls of honour held at the Commission's head office commemorating by name all the Commonwealth casualties who died in Iraq during the two world wars. Close inspection of these rolls at the headquarters in Maidenhead reveals that the names of the Indian rank and file do indeed appear in them. So the registers, rather than the memorial itself, have been used as their basis. And this text tells you that it's very difficult to go to Iraq at the moment, and so the Commission has erected this alternative memorial in Maidenhead. So the question that increasingly began to puzzle me is, why are the Singhs not on the database? To make these new rolls of honour displayed at Maidenhead, the Commission has presumably digitised the registers of the memorial. It seems unlikely that they would type out or scan 33,000 names into their computer and not include them on the Debt of Honour database. And I became increasingly puzzled by this. A quick look at the memorial's register, which there's a copy at the Imperial War Museum, showed that all but two of the casualties from the 36 Sikhs carried the name Singh, so that's 151 Singhs. The task of counting Singhs in the end defeated me, but before that point, I had found 127 in the 35th, 93 in the 37th, 290 in the 51st, 121 in the 52nd, 207 in the 53rd, and 71 in the 54th Sikhs. I'll just give you a few more examples. I could go on for a very long time, but I promise you I'm not going to. The Sikhs pioneers yielded 24 from the 32nd, 51 from the 34th, and so on. Glancing at the Punjabi regiments, I started with 46 in the 25th, and etc. I gave up when I got to the casualties of the 4th Prince Albert Victor's Rajputs, or Singhs. Now, unlike the native Africans of the interwar period, these Singhs have almost certainly not been deliberately sent missing by the present-day Wargraves Commission. And this is my attempt at an explanation of how this can be, and I'm very interested to hear if I'm wrong, which some of you may tell me I am, and if so, what the other interpretation is. The original registers for the Basra Memorial adopted the usual practice for the British names of putting a surname or family name first, followed by the individual or given name, mostly, of course, Christian names. For the Indian names, however, the order was reversed, as we see in the following example. Now, I hope you can see it. So there's British names, the end of the list of British names there. So Wynne, Captain Eric Ralph, etc. Woodward, Lieutenant Edward Seymour, etc. So they put the surname first, and then the rank, and then the given name. What they decided to do, I don't know why, is the Indian names are all in the format of Abdul Ali, Abdul Huk, Amar Singh, etc. Now, the reason for this is not clear. This is where some of you may be able to correct me, but it seems to me that India's naming systems don't typically go in that order. But if, however, you type the given name into the Wargraves Commission's database box where you should put a surname or family name, they do come up on the Wargraves Commission register. So, for example, the details of Ajab Singh will come up if you search for Ajab S. And there it is. I type in Ajab as the surname. Sikh, I've put, because I don't think it is the surname. And this very one that I'm looking for does come up. Now, this is a whole page of Singhs that I found by typing in the name Lakhman. And it says at the top there are 190 records that match your search. So I found 190 Singhs by typing in the name Lakhman. Now, Ram is a very popular given name, and entered as a family name, it generates a bit of a shock to the system. Too many to print them out. 2,258 Singh casualties that come up only if you put Ram in as the family name. And I tried this out with Mohammed to see what happened, and I got 1358, and apparently only one Patel died in the First World War. Now, it seems astonishing that so large a project as this could make what seems to me to be a fundamental mistake, and that no one at the Wargraves Commission has noticed that for an enormous number of Indian names, the family and given names had been reversed. This means, paradoxically, that the Indian officers whose names were actually engraved on the memorial are almost impossible to find in the modern database. Then there was discrimination by rank, and no doubt also by social rank. Now that discrimination has been inadvertently, we must assume, reversed. It's much easier to find an Indian follower or driver who only had one name recorded in the register. For example, driver Anoki, who is commemorated in perpetuity and easily accessible. So the CWGC has created a database where anyone searching for an ancestor who died in pre-partition Indian army in Mesopotamia would be lucky to find the information that could be made available. bring back Sir Arthur Brown and his insistence that the commission must do their best to engrave inscriptions at which no one with a knowledge of India can reasonably cavil. The Basra Memorial continues to pose the problem of how to present the appearance of equal treatment when differences of rank, race, and creed have actually proved determining of whether or not any given individual is commemorated. As Chettle, the Director of Records at the Wargrave Commission, put it himself, in hand-picking very carefully the wording of an inscription going up at Mosul, he said, "It's the only method I can think of by which to avoid the difficulty that the British names will be recorded on the Basra Memorial, but not the Indian names. A certain casuistry is an element of the Commission's impression management." At the 143rd meeting of the Wargraves Commission, the Vice-Chairman, Fabian Ware, asked the meeting for suggestions as to an inscription indicating that the names of those commemorated were in the register, but not on the memorial. And after discussion, the minutes tell us, a proposal was made which was taken forward. Mr. Kipling suggested that a Persian word which meant the Book of the Dead might be inscribed on the register box with the English words, "Their names are in the book," i.e. their names are in the book, their names are not on the memorial. Now the Imperial Wargraves Commission, IWGC, was aware that many mistakes had been made during the war in the disposition of dead Indian soldiers and followers. After the war, a policy was worked out attempting to reduce some of the damage, or as I increasingly think, reduce some of the evidence of the damage. The circumstances at Gallipoli, where many Indian soldiers died, led Lieutenant Colonel Hughes, Deputy Director of Works there, to discuss the matter with General Cox and determine a policy. One simple principle that was established was that, and I'm going to quote because you might find this surprising, in the case where Hindus and Muslims are mixed up together and unidentified, a decision should be taken as to which should be ignored. Similarly, where individual Muslims are buried in Christian cemeteries, these graves should not be marked or action taken. The policy regarding Muslims was no exhumation. Musulman graves should not be touched or bodies removed. The policy for Hindus included Sikhs and Gurkhas and was directing at redressing the proscribed burial of Hindu soldiers. Quote, "Where it is known for certain that Hindus have been buried, their remains should be exhumed, burnt, and taken out to sea to be scattered on the water by Hindu soldiers under a Hindu officer, or if a Hindu regiment is returning to India, they should be given the opportunity to take the ashes back with them." The Commission's policy of the interwar period, treating people differently according to their race and religion, faced its most challenging test in the case of cemeteries containing a cultural variety of bodies. An important element of the initial context of their policy was the question of whether graves would be visited by relatives, and public visibility generally was also an issue. It was thought that relatives and visitors would travel to the Western Front, but that graves in other theatres of war were unlikely to be visited, which is why, as some of you may know, the Neuve-Chapelle Memorial in France on the Western Front does commemorate by name about 5,000 Indian soldiers who died there, because the policy on the Western Front was commemoration of everybody by name, and this policy of not commemorating by name applies outside Europe on the grounds that people would never want to go to these memorials. Another factor that became apparent in East Africa was that the IWGC had a completely different attitude towards and practice of commemoration of Indian soldiers than it did for Africans. And this becomes a problem when they're both in the same place. Internal papers from meetings at the Commission in the 1920s illustrate the problem. In June 1923, Director of Records was prepared to agree that native graves should not be individually marked, but the course should not apply to Indians. In March 1924, Director of Records stated that collective commemoration will be decided on for Indians in all but European countries, except where Indian graves are amongst British. This problem came to a head in discussions about how to handle headstones at Seaview Cemetery in Dar es Salaam, and in the end, Brown had to write to the governor of Tanganyika to ask his advice. This cemetery, this is the problem he faced, or that his policy got him into, the cemetery had Christian and non-Christian sections and contained graves of various categories that would be marked with headstones. They included South African soldiers, Cape Corps, the British West India Regiment, miscellaneous Europeans, and Chinese. This left the Indian and African natives to be considered. And Brown, having explained the position, pointed out that if, therefore, the commission adhere to their usual policy, the result will be that in the Christian plot, there will be about 40 scattered headstones commemorating members of the units mentioned above, while the remainder of the known and identified graves of Indians and West Africans will have no marking. He noted that the argument that had been used with other Indian graves in East Africa, that the names were not known, did not apply. In this case, he says, the African and Indian graves are properly recorded and identified, and concluded that the argument based on imperfection of records therefore falls to the ground. Brown's question to the governor was whether this marked differentiation of treatment will not cause unfavourable comment, and whether all the graves should be given headstones to avoid this. It appears that the effects of the Commission's usual policy were thought just too anomalous. Dar es Salaam recurs as the exception to the rule, and constant references, I found the Indians buried at Dar es Salaam are an exception since their names are to be individually inscribed. No individual commemoration of East African natives except at Dar es Salaam for special reasons. No individual commemoration of West African natives except at Dar es Salaam. No individual commemoration of South African natives except at Dar es Salaam, etc. Now, I want to make a point in conclusion simply about sort of what's happening more recently. The decision that was taken at Basra was in line with other memorials in the Middle East, for example. So one thing that might be worth mentioning is the situation at Port Tewfik. In 1924, Arthur Brown had a discussion with General Cobb of the India Office about this memorial, which is on the Suez Canal. Cobb thought that the engraving of the names of all Indian soldiers would have little interest and that they would never be seen by the relatives. But in line with its later thinking, the War Graves Commission replaced it when it was destroyed in Israeli-Egyptian fighting in 1967 with a memorial near Cairo on which the names that they had from the registers were actually engraved. And it seems that the present-day commission is intending, after the war in Iraq, to do something similar with the Basra Memorial. And I'm going to just conclude by reading you out a quotation from some earlier state. I wrote to the War Graves Commission to say, hey, what do you think about all this? And they replied, in the instances where we do not have the names and commemorations are by number, for example, the African memorials, it was accepted that no more could be done. But elsewhere, when names have been recorded in registers, there was the option to correct the anomalies. In 1995, my predecessor therefore took the decision that these inequalities should be corrected where it was possible and practicable to do so, and began a program which would, in the first instance, record some 8,000 names on memorials in the Middle East, Africa, and Hong Kong. Now, in fact, the one in Hong Kong was recently installed and carries the newly engraved names of 941 Chinese who died in the First World War who have never previously been publicly commemorated by name. It was accepted, he carries on, that this would take place over a period of some years and be subject to other priorities. But a number of new memorials have since been completed, and the memorial in Hong Kong will be erected shortly. It was erected soon after that. The Basra Memorial does, of course, present an additional significant challenge, but you would have noticed from the display in Maidenhead that the new memorial books now record Indian troops equally with their European comrades, And when we come to consider the options for replacing the memorial, equality will be paramount.